You're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Liquid Lunch with the Regional Water Authority. My name is Kevin Watsey and I'm the Director of Public Affairs at the Regional Water Authority, but more importantly, I'm a water nerd. I love to talk about water, water systems, water infrastructure, water treatment, water quality, wastewater, stormwater, gray water. What is gray water? Listen, we'll talk about it at some point. Bottled water versus tap water, and our topic today, water distribution systems. But before we get into water distribution systems, I want to talk a little bit about what Liquid Lunch with the RWA is all about. It's a show where we'll spend time talking to experts about various water topics in the greater New Haven area. We'll also plan to talk to community leaders to discuss issues and opportunities in their community, and leaders of NGOs and nonprofits, where they'll tell us about all the good things that are happening in their world. Our goal is to educate, inform, and promote all the wonderful things happening in the region. But let's talk about today's show. So what are we going to talk about today? I'm very excited because we're actually going to be talking about a new initiative that the Regional Water Authority kicked off recently. It was 18 months in the making at the water company, and that is our service line inventory. Joining us today to talk about the necessity and the importance of this initiative to the water company and the customers is Tom Barger. Tom is the manager of water quality at the RWA and is also the team lead on this project. Tom, before we start discussing this initiative, I like to ask my guests to tell us their story, where you came from. Tell us about yourself. So before we start talking about the service line inventory, welcome to the show and tell us your story.
Hey, Kevin, thanks so much. Really, I'm really honored and happy to be here this afternoon. So, yeah, I guess I was raised here in the greater New Haven area. I've lived here my whole life. Going to high school, I was always very interested in the sciences, and that stayed with me, you know, through my college experience. You know, in getting out of school and being interested in the sciences, I've also had an appreciation for the importance of giving back to the community. So I've been really lucky and fortunate to be able to kind of take those two things that have been very important to me and bring them together into the Regional Water Authority. So when I applied for the job, I started out collecting water samples for the authority, and, you know, it stayed with me. I'm doing something, I'm contributing, I'm giving back to the community. I had a number of things kind of go right. Everything kind of falls into place over a period of time. So I was able to stay with the authority as other people were retiring. Science was gaining more credibility and part of the playing field, if you will, in 1985 when I started. So I've been hanging around for a while. It's been very educational for me. It's been very satisfying for me being able to bring the science to, you know, public water here in the greater New Haven area.
1985. So that's putting you close to 39 years with the RWA.
Yeah, this summer will be 39 years with the RWA.
So let me ask you, so you've been doing water quality, water science for 39 years. What do you think has been the biggest change in how either the RWA handles water quality or really how the government looks at water quality in the 39 years?
Yeah, there's so many things to talk about, Kevin. But I think, you know, most importantly, when I started in 1985, you were only 11 years into the Safe Drinking Water Act. So what I've seen develop over a period of time is a significant number of science-based regulatory directives coming out of the Environmental Protection Agency specific to, you know, public drinking water systems. I think that's a huge piece of it. You know, the application of science is continuing to evolve, and bringing those fundamentals to public health and the public water systems, I think is probably the most significant.
And I think we're going to talk about one of those changes today on the show.
Yeah, for sure. So
as I mentioned earlier, we're going to talk about the RWA Service Line Inventory Initiative. Before we get into that, I think that it's really good if we kind of level set and explain to our audience kind of how a water distribution system works and exactly what a service line is. So can you kind of give a high level overview of what is a service line?
Yeah, sure. And this is, you know, it's very basic information, but without it, you know, you're starting from a point of disadvantage. So, you know, when you look at a water service line, it's actually the pipe that connects the water main in the street to your home or business. It's that section of line, typically bisected. One part of that is the responsibility of typically of the utility, in this case, Regional Water. And the balance of that line would be the responsibility of the property owner. So it's looking to identify the nature of that service line.
And so when you say it's bisected, so the water company is responsible for part, the homeowner is responsible for part. So can you explain who's responsible for what?
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah, the section of water main, section of service line, excuse me, between the water main and roughly the curb line is the responsibility of the water authority. So if that line were to leak or break or whatever, you know, that becomes the responsibility of the water authority to either repair or replace. And then the section of pipe that goes from the curb line into the premise, a home, business, what have you, would be the responsibility of the property owner. So if there would be a leak or break, it would be the property owner's responsibility to then make that repair replacement, you know, through the, you know, the plumbing contractor of choice.
And so, as I've mentioned a few times, the RWA is starting a service line inventory, which is exactly what it sounds like, right? So we're going to be taking an inventory of the service lines in our area. And Tom, kind of talk about why we're doing that now and what we're looking for and why we're doing it.
Sure. So when this inventory was developed, the need to develop this inventory was first discussed. It's really associated with one of those regulations that I spoke of earlier that comes out of the Environmental Protection Agency, specifically the lead and copper rule. Now, the lead and copper rule itself, not to go too far back into the weeds, but really it's been around since 1991. It is the regulation that's keeping an eye on lead and copper exposure to folks. What has developed over a period of time, you know, as a result of the Flint, Michigan experience and other communities around the United States that have been challenged by lead in particular, is the need to really inventory where that lead may be coming from, right? So, I mean, we're all familiar with certain forms of lead exposure in the environment, not the least of which may be paint, you know, back in the 1970s and earlier. But I think the importance of inventorying a water service line helps us to better appreciate what the composition of that line might be. You know, if you go back far enough, 100, 120, 130 years ago, lead was not an uncommon plumbing material to use. We obviously don't use that anymore. We've learned a lot, you know, in the subsequent decades, but, you know, a lot of the historical plumbing may still be out there. This inventory effort is an attempt to get our arms around the realities of what might be out there in terms of plumbing.
So you mentioned two words that I think may have made our listeners kind of perk up a little bit: lead and flint. Are we talking about a flint-like lead issue here in the New Haven area?
No, not at all. I mean, the whole flint issue was very complicated. You know, lead was just one component. It had a lot to do with that particular issue, had a lot to do with how that system and other systems in the state of Michigan were managed at that point in time. I think Flint was undergoing some significant financial struggles. That whole city government, I believe, was taken over by the state of Michigan at that point in time. The water system was taken over for sure. And I think there were some decisions made that, in hindsight, obviously were not the best decisions that could have been made, maybe were inappropriate. You know, I don't want to get into too much of that just because it's not really what we're here to talk about. But I think there's so many checks and balances here in Connecticut, where not the least of which is the fact that here public water systems are overseen by a public health agency. And I think that's critically important. Not every state has that. I think our eye is always on the ball here in Connecticut with respect to public health. And I think oversight of water utilities from that group is very, very important.
And so the issue that happened in Flint, we really, our listeners, our customers, the RWA consumers, really don't have to worry about something like that happening here in our system.
That's correct.
Correct.
That's correct. There's again, any number of checks and balances that would, you know, we would avoid that situation.
And so you said now that the lead and copper rule has been around for, you know, 40 or so years. And I imagine that there was some lead pipes in the system back when that was implemented. So can you talk a little bit about what the RWA does to protect customers from lead and, you know, in the event that they do have a lead service line?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a number of things, Kevin. You know, it's not kind of a one size fits all solution. So there's a number of things that have been done. You know, the Water Authority back in the 70s had proactively removed any lead service lines that we were aware of under the utility ownership or responsibility, as we explained earlier, you know, between the water main and the curb line. A lot of that was done 50 years ago.
So even before the lead and copper rule, the RWA was taking lead out of their side of the system.
That's correct.
Now, why didn't they take it out of the other side, the customer side?
Well, I think in part because we didn't know where it may have been on the customer side, right? Because we didn't do any of that plumbing. A lot of the plumbing was done by the homeowner in relationship with whatever plumbing contractor they wanted to do business with. So we didn't necessarily know it was there.
And ultimately, it's the homeowners, that's their line.
For sure.
So we weren't about to go and touch a line that we weren't responsible for.
Right? No, that's correct.
Right.
That's
correct. Sorry, I cut you off. So we were talking about what the RWA does to protect customers.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that we're currently doing, and we've been doing this since roughly 1978, we've been adding a corrosion inhibitor to the water. It's a chemistry that separates the water from the plumbing itself in an effort to make sure that those two are not, you know, coming into contact with each other and forming any type of leachate, if you will. So that's something that we do. We monitor for it on a regular basis. It's part of our regular protocols for monitoring of water quality in the distribution system from, you know, nearly three dozen locations.
And how do we know that corrosion control chemical is safe?
Yeah, excellent question. Obviously, we're not allowed to put anything in the water that hasn't been deemed to be, you know, safe to consumers. USDA is involved in the approval process or all of that. And we're monitoring that. We're adding that at a concentration of about one part per million. And we're monitoring not only, you know, as we add that to the water, but also in the distribution system, we're monitoring what the resultant concentrations are and keeping a very close eye on that.
So it sounds like whether or not a homeowner has a lead line, we've been protecting them, right?
No, for sure. I mean, it's like I say, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. There's a number of different things that the Water Authority is actively engaged in. And again, public health protection is job one.
And does the RWA regularly test for lead in the water?
No, we do, for sure. I mean, there's any number of opportunities for us to do that. We're looking for lead on a quarterly basis just for background information on the water sources, you know, the different places that we take water out of the environment. We're monitoring for that in the water distribution system as required of us by that regulation, the lead and copper rule that's been out there since 1991. We do a lot of monitoring for lead for citizens who have concerns. Maybe they are afraid they may have some lead plumbing in the house, you know, that may have, you know, existed for 100 years now. We do a lot of monitoring for schools and daycares and places like that that have lead monitoring requirements as part of their licensing. So, you know, we're trying to provide this type of information to a wide swath of our consumer base.
And has the RWA ever, I guess, failed a lead test? Have we ever exceeded the limits?
No, never. I mean, since 1991, when we're monitoring this, we've never had an exceedance. We have exceedingly low concentrations of lead. The only time that we have seen bump up in any type of concentration is specifically associated with domestic plumbing modifications. You know, things that folks have done to their own homes for whatever reason. Maybe they're not the greatest, you know, do-it-yourself plumber, or there has been some type of internal modification to the plumbing system that has resulted in an elevation in lead. But you know, nothing in the water that we're distributing.
So corrosion control works.
Yeah, everything's been working really, really well for us in that regard, for sure.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about the inventory now. So we have, the RWA has roughly 120,000 service connections.
Correct. That's correct.
And the RWA needs to develop an inventory of every one of those service lines. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the ways the RWA is going about doing this?
Yeah, sure. Just to kind of step back for just half a second here.
Sure.
You know, when we're looking at the inventory, the inventory requirement that's been placed upon us is not specific to any particular type of service line. So for instance, you know, we have service lines that are specifically out there for supplying water to homes, right, for domestic use. We have other service lines that are there exclusively for fire suppression, right? Like in a building, if you're in a building with a sprinkler system, you know, like the one that we're sitting in this afternoon, you know, that has a fire service line. There are service lines for irrigation. There are service lines for community, you know, support. So the regulation is not specific to any one. All of them have to be included in the inventory, regardless of when they were installed, what they're composed of, how large they are, any reason whatsoever. So, you know, the first thing that we did to start to develop this inventory is look at our own records, right? We have a lot of records, a lot of written records from back in the day. The oldest service line records that I've seen go back into the 1890s. So we're capturing a lot of that information. We've reached out to our municipal partners to say, gee, you know, in your plumbing inspector's office or your building inspector's office, do you have any of the old records that may help us and assist us? So we're, you know, looking to our partners to help us provide that information. I think one of the other things that we're doing not much more recently now is we're going out and doing vacuum excavations. So we're out in the neighborhood with a vacuum truck. It's not unlike the same type of truck your, you know, municipal Department of Public Works may use, you know, in different applications. It's designed to excavate, you know, a relatively small hole, like a large dinner plate sized hole, you know, a circular hole that goes down to the service line where we can get eyes on it and we can, you know, develop that information where these paper records just may not exist. We're doing a variety of other things. We're asking people to do self-identification of their service line based on, you know, what may come into their home and, you know, breach the foundation of the house. So there's a number of ways that we can try to get this information, you know, without being overly invasive or, you know, interrupt anybody's private space.
So you mentioned a lot of ways, and I want to kind of spend a little bit of time talking about each one of those ways, because each one of them has their own positives and negatives. And I think some of our listeners may have questions about each one of those. So You mentioned vacuum excavation. Is that something that all 120,000 of RWA's customers are going to experience?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, really what we're looking for here, Kevin, is, you know, if you look at a neighborhood, we can estimate, you know, based on the age of the neighborhood, things that are going on and things that we're aware of, different points of information that we're aware of, we may have a pretty good idea of what we would expect. We don't necessarily need to go into every home to confirm that. What we look to do is identify maybe a representative address or two or three in a particular neighborhood to be able to go in and confirm the information that we think we know. And in that way, we can start to utilize a software program. We're working with a consulting engineering firm, and we can use that information as part of their machine learning aspect of this software to help us gather, again, additional information where it makes sense to this particular computer software program. And we can start to fill in some of those blanks that we may currently have. So we're going to do a relatively small percentage of our customer base, but I think that's going to provide us with just a lot of information that we need. And we don't have to necessarily inconvenience, you know, folks, you know, one house after another.
Okay. And so for the lucky customers where we are going to do vacuum excavation, a couple of questions. So you said that the hole that we're digging is relatively small. So what, about 10, 12 inches in diameter?
That's correct.
And is the RWA, are they digging on the private property, or how does the RWA figure out where you're going to dig?
Yeah, I think, you know, the site selection is based on where we have some absence of information. So where we may have, you know, data gaps, we're really focusing on those areas. We also want to be able to confirm what we think we know. So if we have some records for, you know, if you went to my house in Hamden, for instance, and I think I have a copper line, well, maybe you want to do an excavation on that, on my house, to be able to confirm that the records that we have from 1948 were correct, right? So I think we need to do a little bit of validation as well. But, you know, we're working within the municipal right-of-way. So, you know, not everybody may be aware of the fact that the paved area of the street is not the complete ownership of what the municipality has access to. It's roughly 10 feet on either side of that curb line is considered the right-of-way. So what we're trying to do is stay within that right-of-way to do the work that we need to do to identify service lane material. But we don't want to be excavating in the middle of somebody's, you know, landscaping. We don't want to be creating problems on, you know, digging up unnecessarily sidewalks or pavers or anything like that. We'll stay away from all of that. We don't want this to become an inconvenience for folks. So we're going to try to stay on the municipal right of way. We're not going to try to broach any type of private property. And we're certainly not going to look to disrupt, you know, what people have as far as landscaping, plantings. You know, we don't want to excavate necessarily next to a tree or something and do some root damage. We're not looking to create new problems, right? We're trying to solve some of the questions that we have currently in place.
And should I be worried that this vacuum excavation, that it might damage my service line? Or, you know, is it a pretty gentle?
Yeah, relatively speaking, I mean, compared to a backhoe, it's certainly a heck of a lot, you know, calmer in nature than a backhoe. It's very controlled. You know, it's a vacuum hose. It's like a large vacuum cleaner, right? So we don't intend to do any damage other than, again, a cylinder of space going down to the service line. Let us see what that service line is. We immediately fill that hole back in, you know, put the sod back up on top of that hole. And, you know, before we drive away, it's as if we were never there.
Oh, so the holes are being closed same day, restored as if the contractor was
out
there.
Absolutely. There's nothing left for anybody to be concerned about. No open excavations, no holes, no cones. You're not going to be, folks walking dogs down the sidewalk are not going to be inconvenienced. We're in, we're out, we're done.
Great. Well, I think this is a good time for me to tell folks who may have just joined this that you're listening to Liquid Lunch with the Regional Water Authority. This is a public affairs show that where we discuss all things water as well as good things happen in the community. And today we're talking to Tom Barger, who's the water quality manager at the RWA, and we're discussing RWA service line inventory program. And at the end of the show, if you sit tight, we'll be discussing a couple other water quality topics. But if you want to know what they are, you're just going to have to listen. So getting back to the service line inventory, we talked a little bit about vacuum excavation. You had mentioned self-identify. So what does that mean? So if I'm a homeowner, I can call the RWA and tell you what my service line is made of?
Yeah, I think if you go onto our website, the rwaourwater.com website, and you get into our water quality information, specifically into our lead page, you know, there's a QR code in there. And I think the QR code is going to provide you with some instruction as to, you know, if you go down to the basement of the house, you know, how do you identify your water line? You know, the water line looks different than the gas line type of thing. You identify what your water line is. And it's kind of a step-by-step, you know, process of identifying what that water line may be composed of, right? So is it galvanized iron? Is it brass? Is it copper? Is it plastic? There's any number of different materials that could have been used. Now, it's inside your house. We may not be familiar with what it is. We may have set the meter 20 years ago, but we didn't really take into consideration at the time what that service line was, right? Because it's private property. It's really not on our radar until this inventory requirement came along. So if folks can help us identify what that material is, then we don't need to come into your house. We don't inconvenience you. You can provide us the information we need. We can fill in the blank on our end. You know, we can make our regulators happy. And we know what our inventory looks like with the assistance of our consumers.
So you mentioned meter changes. So that brings up a good point. So if the RWA is out doing a meter change or any other work inside a basement, you know, necessary work, are those folks just going to look at the service line on their own and put it in the system so that the RWA doesn't have to bug me?
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you know, we're coming in to change a meter, like you say, if we're in there doing some other valve work, if we have a need to be in the basement for some other reason, you know, we'll take that opportunity to record what that service line material. And again, this is the line that's coming through the foundation of your house. We're recording what the nature of that material is. Again, is it plastic? Is it copper, brass, iron, whatever it happens to be? We're recording that. We're doing the same thing as part of our cross-connection control program. Now, that's a Think of that as a specialized group of plumbing inspectors. These are all licensed plumbers here in Connecticut. They happen to work for the Water Authority. We're focusing their activities mostly in the commercial industrial spaces where they're doing their work. But again, we have to record the service line material for anyone and everyone, right? Regardless of what that might be. It could be the biggest business in New Haven. It could be the smallest home in New Haven. It doesn't matter. All of these service lines have to be inventoried. So we're gathering all of this information as a normal course of business using Water Authority personnel each and every day. But we're obviously not everywhere every day. So that's why we have these other alternatives, the vacuum excavation, the self-identification, to help supplement, you know, the information that we need to gather.
All right. And if I'm an RWA customer, how do I know if you're going to do this vacuum excavation at my house?
Yeah, I think, again, I think we're looking at certain areas of our system, Kevin, where we're, you know, we're a little bit data poor, right? So we want to increase the volume of information we have in certain areas. So we're communicating with folks in the neighborhood. You know, if we've identified your neighborhood, you're going to be getting a letter from us that's going to say, hey, you know what? Listen, you can see all the paint out on the pavement. A lot of the utilities are doing their markouts. The water company is going to be here, and this is what we're doing. We need to develop an inventory. So we want to make sure that everyone in the neighborhood is aware of it. If we're actually going to be coming to your house, you're going to get a supplementary, you know, communication from us that's going to say, hey, you know what? We've identified your particular home because we want to utilize that as the representative of the neighborhood type of thing. And so you'll get a communication. If we get there and it doesn't look right to us, if you have those plantings, those pavers, that landscaping, and it really isn't appropriate for us to be doing the work at your home because, it again, we don't want to be, you know, invasive. We don't want to be disrupting people's, you know, peace of mind type of thing. You know, we'll move on to one of your neighbor's homes that's maybe more suitable because it can provide us the information that we need as well.
Okay, so that's good information. So if I'm a Joe homeowner and I get the door hanger and the RWA or the contractor, you're using contractors, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
It's what's the name of the contractor?
It's a McVac.
McVac. Okay.
That's a New Haven vacuum excavation contractor. Some of your listeners may be aware they're over on Grand Avenue.
Great. So McVac shows up at my house. I'm Joe homeowner. And they do this vacuum excavation and they fill the hole back in the same day. Is the RWA going to tell me what you found?
Yeah, you know, for sure. There's another door hanger that's going to be left behind. It's going to tell you what, you know, what we found in the front yard there. You know, look, your service line is made out of copper. It's made out of brass. If there's any concern about, you know, a lead line or a galvanized iron line, there's follow-up communication from the RWA. We may want to come into your basement to see if that line actually comes in to the basement. There'll be some follow-up information, you know, regarding that. So it's not going to be something where, you know, if we're concerned about what we find, that you're going to be left high and dry, you know, there's going to be a lot of follow-up from the RWA at that point.
Right. So if the RWA finds that I might have a lead service line, what do I have to do?
Yeah, I don't think you have to necessarily do anything. We're going to be providing you with any type of precautionary type of information, give you some follow-up as to, you know, really what you can and should be doing as I'll call it an avoidance strategy, right? Really nothing different than what we have said to consumers for many, many years, you know, about flushing the water after it's been sitting idle for any period of time. That's just good practice. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't necessarily want to just consume water without, you know, running it, right? I mean, I think we all, that's common sense. So it's nothing above and beyond really what we've been telling customers for years.
So I don't have to call a plumber and have my line replaced tomorrow?
No, I mean, we still have that corrosion control happening. We practice that on a daily basis. That's something that's an integral part of our treatment process. So that never turns off. That's something that's there all the time. And then we're going to be developing this inventory, and ultimately from the inventory is going to be a replacement plan, a sampling plan. That's all a little further down the road. We have to discover what's out there first as part of the inventory program. And from there, we'll build upon that with information that we have to develop over time.
So really the inventory is just the first step in a multi-step process to comply with this lead and copper rule.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's a huge first step. We're well underway. You know, we have our plans in place. We're following those plans. As soon as we gather this information and we have a more fully developed inventory, you know, then you step off to the subsequent steps. And, we're getting there.
So what, I guess, what's the RWA doing with all this information? So now you've done these vacuum excavations, you've had some customers self-report, you've had your own folks who are going in basements do some reporting. I guess, what happens to all of this? What happens to the inventory?
Yeah, we have all this inventory currently in a software program that our consulting engineer has developed. Ultimately, that same information is going to go into the State of Connecticut Department of Public Health's service line inventory template. So that's something that all the water utilities in Connecticut that have to comply with this particular facet of the regulation are going to have to complete. I can't even begin to tell you how much information is in there, Kevin, but it's a sizable, you know, spreadsheet that we're going to have to develop. From there, that information is also going to be in a GIS-based mapping system that will be on our website. So the middle of October 2024, so a few months down the road, that's going to go live on our website. It's going to be an interactive map. You'll be able to place, as a consumer, you'll be able to place an address in the query, and the map will take you to that address. Ultimately, as we continue to build the inventory, the information relative to what we found. So service line material that's on the utility side of responsibility is going to be there, and what that material is. Is it a lead line? Is it a iron line? Is it a copper line? Whatever it is, that's going to be made available, as will the private side information. So, you know, you'll have a full picture of what that service line material is for any given address in the city.
So if I'm a homeowner, can I opt out of that? If I don't want my address on this searchable map that you're talking about, can I opt out of that?
Yeah, we have not been given that option that there's an opt out. You know, we have to provide the entire map. We have to provide all the information that we have gathered, and it has to all be inclusive.
That's right. And that goes up, if I'm correct, in October, correct?
Yeah, mid-October of this year. Yeah, it's a responsibility we have to the regulation. So there's really not even anything the RWA can do in terms of options or electives. I mean, this is all compliance-based regulatory directives that we're satisfying here.
So is there anything that I may not have asked you, anything else about this specific project, this service line inventory that you think our listeners should know that we might not have hit on?
I don't think so. I mean, this is a significant undertaking. I mean, like I said, earlier in the conversation, I've been here for almost 39 years. I haven't seen anything in my history with the Water Authority that equals this. I mean, this is a formidable regulatory directive to try to satisfy. You know, it's a lot of information that's really outside our traditional wheelhouse. You know, a lot of this is plumbing, and yeah, we're very familiar with plumbing, but now, you know, we're gathering information from private property, and some folks may be sensitive to that, and I can certainly understand. But I would just ask folks to be patient with the Water Authority. We're trying to identify materials that can be harmful to folks, right? I mean, lead is not something that you want to necessarily be dealing with on a daily basis, and we're trying to discover where that may be historically from, you know, when it was installed 120, 130 years ago. So I just ask folks to have patience with what we're trying to accomplish in the interest of public health.
And the one thing I would just add to that too. So, you know, if the listeners are take one thing from this conversation, and we've mentioned it a couple of times, but I really want to mention it again. It's that the RWA really has been protecting its customers now for 40 plus years with this corrosion control program. So, you know, the word lead, it may sound scary, and in some parts of the country it is scary, but for us, you know, we've been protecting our customers. We have a corrosion control program. We will continue to protect you. The corrosion control program is not going away. So if you are somebody who receives a notice from us after our investigation that you might have a lead service line, there really is no need to worry because we're going to continue doing what we've done for 40 years. Would you agree, Tom?
No, I would, Kevin. I mean, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that back up. Again, this is something that we're looking to do. You almost look at this point with lead service line or any lead plumbing removal as somewhat preemptive, right? I mean, let's just get it out of there. We're doing what we need to do with the corrosion control program. It's been very, very successful. We've been compliant with all the lead laws, you know, all the way through our history. This is just something that we want to make sure that we're just, you know, crossing every T, dotting every I, doing everything that we can as a utility, you know, to make sure that everybody's going to be fine with this particular issue.
Great. Well, I think this was a really good, important discussion. And, from what I understand, the vacuum excavation trucks are going to be out in full force throughout the summer in every one of the 15 towns served by the RWA. So there's nobody that won't be touched by this program over the next few months, correct?
That's correct. I mean, we have 15 communities that we distribute water. I was out on one of the trucks in East Haven, you know, earlier today. You know, they're doing good work out there. And, you know, we're going to be touching, you know, all 15 communities over the course of the spring, summer, and fall.
Great. And if you're listening and you have any questions about this program, the service line inventory, the RWA has actually created a special phone number. It's 833-RWA-LEAD. That's 833-792-5323. So if you do have any questions, you can feel free to call that number. We'd be happy to answer your questions. And if you just joined us, you are listening to Liquid Lunch with the RWA. Today, we're talking to Tom Barger, the manager of water quality at the RWA. And I do want to hit you with two other non-service line topics, because I think they're... at least one of them is kind of ever present in the news right now. So last week, the Environmental Protection Agency actually introduced some new regulations on chemicals known as PFAS, PFAS, PFOS, things like that. And I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that. I know I saw some reports on the news and in the newspapers about that. So can you give a quick explanation to our listeners about what is PFAS?
Yeah, this is going to be the very high 50,000 foot explanation.
We're not chemists.
The PFAS compounds, you can think of those, and there's about 15,000 of them. I guess it depends on, you know, who you ask as to what that number ends up being or being reported out at. But these are various non-stick surfaces, right? So these are typically, the anti-grease, anti-oil, you know, water-resistant type of products that are, you know, well represented, in our world as consumers. It's in, you know, thousands of different compounds from, you know, anti-stick surfaces like Teflon to Scotchgard to Tire Shine to, you know, any number of things out there. It's in cosmetics. It's in dental floss. It's in so many different things. So this is a large group of similar chemical compounds that have recently been formally regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency announcement Wednesday last week.
And what is the limit that they set the main ones?
Yeah, so the main ones, the PFOS and PFOA, 4 parts per trillion. Concentration is the limit for those particular compounds. And then there's 4 other compounds they're regulating in aggregate. And I'm not going to get into how that's done. But it's so, just tip of the iceberg here.
And you said parts per trillion, and I'll give 2 examples of things that I've read that kind of try and explain what a part per trillion is. One of them I read said if you took 88,000 tractor trailers and lined them up, and you had to look for a dime size worth of a specific element amongst those 88,000 trucks, that would be like 1 part per trillion. I also heard if you put 4 drops of something in 100 Olympic sized swimming pools, that would be like 4 parts per trillion. So I guess it's a long way of saying a part per trillion is a very, very tiny, I don't even know what to call it, a trace amount of something. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, it's a very, very small number. And you know, as a result, it's challenging, right? It's challenging, you know, regardless of what context, to try to wrap your head around how small that is and how to manage something that's at that type of concentration.
And does the RWA test for these compounds?
We do. Yeah, I mean, we do. We've been monitoring PFAS compounds since 2015, when they first kind of, you know, not hit the news necessarily, but became more concerning. We've been monitoring those consistently. You know, what's interesting for me, Kevin, looking at PFAS is, and now the regulation of PFAS, in my years of doing this, it's the first time that I've run into where you're regulating contaminants while the science is still evolving. Mm. I really think that's going to be challenging for everyone involved. Because I think, yeah, as we continue to learn new things about the potential health effects, and I'm sure that there are health effects, and I think we're still trying to get our arms around those. You know, we also have to develop the analytical sciences to go and can you monitor for a part per trillion? You know, I think you can, but it's a fairly sophisticated process. And not everybody's got one of those sitting in their laboratory, you know, these instruments, they're fairly sophisticated. And then when you look at a water utility's ability to remove these compounds from the environment in the matrix of water chemistry is challenging. So, and I think those are all going to continue to evolve. And as a result, the regulation is going to continue to evolve, which, you know, rightly so, it should, as we're learning more. You know, you should get better at it and do what you need to do. I don't think anybody's arguing those points. But I think what's important for everybody to recognize is as these compounds are very challenging, they will continue to be challenging. And, you know, trying to hit our marks, it's going to take time and effort. And unfortunately, there's going to be a financial aspect to that as well.
And assuming there's no kind of bumps in the road, when would this new EPA regulation actually go into effect?
Yeah, I believe now that it's been, you know, announced and formalized, I believe, and I'm going to have to go back and check on this because it's so new, but it's different. So usually there's a 36-month window for the, the compliance period. I believe there's a 60-month window for this. And I think the reason it's a little bit longer is because of the complexity. You know, I think utilities that haven't really kept up with this for one reason or another are going to have to go out and do a lot more monitoring. They're going to have to see what they have. There's a certain amount of engineering that's going to be required for the design of these treatment systems. And I think there's going to be a fair amount of money that's going to be needed to be raised by the utilities and whatever form they decide to do that. And I think that's why the window of compliance here may be as long as 60 months, just because of the complexity of the issue.
Yeah, so that's a recognition by the EPA that we're going to give you more time to kind of get your arms around it and come into compliance with it if you find that you are above these four parts per trillion. And I'll just tell our listeners, if you do have more questions about PFAS, the RWA has an entire page on our website that talks about PFAS. And as we get results for our testing, we actually post those results. And that's depending on the water, that's quarterly or twice a year, correct?
Yeah, under the current regulation that we're following now, it's a situation, Kevin, where there are some differences in terms of the frequency of sample collection, but we're doing obviously what we need to do. We're doing more than what we need to do, quite frankly, to kind of keep an eye on what's going on. We understand that this regulation was coming. You know, we're not surprised by it. So we've been gathering this information for years now to get a better appreciation for where we stand, you know, when this final rule was going to come out. So, you know, we're in a good place with respect to what we know and how we're going to approach it. So
great. Rwater.com, under the water quality tab, you'll see a PFAS area. You can go read all about it and read more about the results that we've gotten in our water system. Tom, we have a few minutes left, and I couldn't get out of here without talking about the water quality report, also known as the Consumer Confidence Report, mm-hmm. CCR. It's got a whole bunch of names. This is a report that every water company in the country is required to provide to its customers once a year that kind of gives an overview of the results of different water quality tests throughout the prior year. So it's always a year behind, correct?
That's correct.
And so our report will be hitting mailboxes across Greater New Haven sometime last week of April, first week of May. And so, Tom, as the water quality manager, I got a couple of questions for you. That report, does it report on everything that the RWA is testing for?
No, it does not. And I'm glad you brought that up. That's it's kind of a misconception. I think it has a lot to do maybe with how we've entitled that particular report. But no, it's not a comprehensive report on water quality across the region. It's more of an, I refer to it as an exceptions report, Kevin. So, you know, you can appreciate all the regulations that were abiding by. But there's very few things in those regulations that we're actually identifying, right? So I think this report is just a summary of the things that we're required to test for that we actually find and the concentrations at which we find them. So that's really what this report is. If we're abiding by the regulations and everything is fine with respect to compliance, then that data is not going to be in there. Doesn't mean we don't have that data if somebody's interested in it. You know, we're always getting calls from citizens about, oh, how about this or how about that? Or breweries will call us because they need a breakdown on the inorganic chemistry as a function of their business, right? So we'll provide them with a lot of information that they need that doesn't necessarily find its way into this particular water quality report, as you also mentioned, the consumer confidence report.
And how many water quality tests does the RWA do each year, roughly?
Yeah, I think it's just over, 100,000 tests.
100,000. So we're doing 100,000 tests a year, give or take, to ensure that the water that we put into people's homes meets or exceeds all the regulations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important for people to recognize too, and folks wouldn't know this unless we tell them, right? But, the regulations may require the water authority to test for something on an annual basis or test for something on a quarterly basis. You know, things that are obligated of us to analyze on an annual basis, we look for quarterly. Things that are obligated of us to look at quarterly, we typically will look at monthly. Things that may be required of us monthly, we look at weekly. You know, we overanalyze and over-monitor, just because it is the right thing to do. I mean, I'm not comfortable as the water quality manager saying to the constituents of the regional water authority, 425,000 people out there that we serve water to, I'm not going to hang my hat on one test that was done once a year. I'm not comfortable with that.
Right. Because it's a snapshot in time.
That's all it is. And, so I'd rather look at it, at least every quarter, if not every month. I'd rather have more information to be able to make decisions on than simply gather information for compliance reporting purposes. This is data that we can make decisions on as a water utility, and that's how we look at the data.
All right, and let's give people a sneak peek at this water quality report they're going to get in a couple of weeks. Did we meet all the standards we needed to meet?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we always do. I mean, that's our job. That's why we're in business. We're not making cigarettes, right? I mean, we're not doing some crazy stuff. We're monitoring drinking water. If there was going to be a problem with the water quality, you would hear that from the regional water authority when it was happening. It's not going to show up in a report that, we're going to start to sneak into your mailbox, anything like that. I mean, that's not who we are. That's not how we operate.
Well, there you have it. So you are listening to Liquid Lunch with the Regional Water Authority. My name's Kevin Watsy. We're joined by our water quality manager, Tom Barger, today. And I always tell Tom when I talk to him, I feel like I'm taking a PhD level course because I always learn something. And I hope if you've listened to our show that you've learned something as well. I always enjoy the time I spend talking to Tom. So with that, we're going to wrap up today's show. If you've missed any portion of today's show, you can always search for us on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter. You could search for the New Haven Independent and find the Liquid Lunch Show. You can listen to this show every other Wednesday at noon here on 103.5 or on YouTube or any of the other ways I just mentioned. And with that, I'd like to once again thank our guest, Tom Barger, Water Quality Manager for the Regional Water Authority. And thank you and have a good and hydrated day.
You're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM New Haven.